This is Positive Parenting. Parenting expertise and advice from best-selling parenting author and national newspaper columnist, Mr. Dad, Armin Brott.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott. Like so many parents of children with Down syndrome, George Estreich and his wife were shocked by their second daughter's diagnosis right after her birth. And like so many of those parents, they found themselves suddenly thrust into the alien territory of raising a child who is different, a child who is pretty much, kind of in an abstract way, seen as defective by society. As George and his wife struggled to come to terms with their daughter's condition, Laura, that's the name of the daughter, suffered heart failure and had to be force-fed through nasal tubes. Yet, the little girl survived. Soon, the visits to the doctors, the cardiologist, nutritionist, and speech pathologist, and other accommodations that the families made for Laura, they all began to feel normal. What struck George as bizarre, though, was the negativity, both intended and unwitting, that pretty much everything he read about Down syndrome contained. Laura was a child first and not a diagnosis. And the fate that was written into her 47 chromosomes of her DNA was no more tragic than that of any other children who carried their own genetic risks hidden within their supposedly normal bodies. As George himself puts it, it's not the chromosome, but our response to it that shapes the contour of a life.
More with Mr. Dad, Armin Brott, after this. From the MrDad.com radio network.
Hey, Dad.
What?
I can't get the ketchup bottle open.
Here, let me try. Yeah, it's stuck all right.
Anything?
Now watch. If you take your palm like this and smack it on the bottom right here, you can get it open pretty easily. Here you go.
Thanks.
You don't have to be a hero to be a hero. When you adopt a child from foster care, just being there makes all the difference. To find out how you can adopt, please visit our website at AdoptUSKids.org or call 1-888-200-4005. A public service announcement brought to you by Adopt US Kids, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott, and my guest for this part of today's show is George Estreich, who's the author of The Shape of the Eye, a memoir. George, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
You know, as I was reading this, and we'll talk a little bit about the whole shape of the eye thing, I was reminded of a book called The Broken Cord by Michael Doris. Did you ever read that?
I did read that.
Something is kind of similar about that is he kept looking at his son who he had adopted.
Yeah.
And there was something just different about his face, and he couldn't quite place it. And it wasn't until he saw a whole bunch of other kids who had fetal alcohol syndrome that he realized, oh, that's what it is. And you seem to have had kind of a similar moment looking at your daughter's, the shape of her eye.
Well, it's funny. I mean, one thing that's, yes, it's true. And I think that one thing that's similar in a general way is if you're writing a memoir about a kid who's visibly different, then, you're not just making sense of it yourself, but you know other people are making sense of it too, and I write about that. What's interesting for me is, as I write in the book, my mom's Japanese, and so, when Laura was first came along, she wasn't diagnosed before she was born, and so, we're kind of looking at her, and the doctors are kind of looking at her, and it suggested, well, she might have Down syndrome, or maybe we're really looking at ethnicity here. And so, it took a couple weeks for a blood test to come back and resolve that. And
well, how did they not pick that up during the pregnancy? It seems like everybody gets that picked up now.
We didn't test.
Ah.
Teresa's, I write just briefly about this, but her feeling was that she wouldn't have wanted to do a termination. And so, a positive, this is changing now, but an amnio Does carry some small risk of miscarriage, so we didn't test for it at that point.
Right, depending on the age of the mother.
Right,
and, you know,
exactly, yeah. Exactly. So yes, a surprise, and not one that, you know, at first it was, as I write, it was a shock in every way, but I don't know, I feel like a pretty lucky dad now, though I know that seems counterintuitive to some.
No, you hear that a lot, and I actually am one of the reasons why I wanted to have you on was so to ask about that. I've
sure.
been blessed to have three kids who, my youngest has got some neurological things she's developed recently, but for the most part, they've been incredibly healthy, and
yep.
I never think about it for a moment. And how did that change your view of parenthood? I can't imagine this would have been your first choice.
Well, you know, it wasn't something we thought about in terms of a choice or not, really. I mean, it was, but once Laura came along, and you know how it is, you know, if you've ever had a kid who's sick or very sick, you kind of put your head down and go. So it changed, I mean, not to sound too like, you know, Obi-Wan Kenobi or anything, but it changed everything and nothing. It changed everything in that it changed my idea of, you know, what people are and what counts as normal or what spectrum of variation counts as just okay, you know. That was something I hadn't thought about much, and I realized how high that wall was in my own head between normal and abnormal, though I probably wouldn't have admitted it. And so that my thinking on that changed a lot. But the way in which nothing changed was that I realized that most of what I had learned with my older daughter, Ellie, still applied. You know, that, you know, patience works, you know, being nice works, the usual parental virtues work with Laura, and in much the same way, so.
Well, how is it different parenting a child with Down syndrome from a child without? And I'm trying to avoid staying away from the word normal, but.
That's all right.
well, it seems kind of misplaced in a way, but.
Yeah.
But so how is it different?
So, one thing that's different is that you get unmoored a little bit from a sense of what someone should be doing at such and such an age. You know, like you know, walking and talking at one or whatever, something like that. You kind of realize that each kid has their own calendar. So that's different. Especially, you know, in the early years, I mean, we're very fortunate to have now early intervention so that, you know, Laura could get especially the speech therapy she needed, but also physical therapy and so on. So you actually learn a lot. You know, the way that I put it in the book was that with Ellie, we just learned to speak the language of childhood, but with Laura, we became linguists, like we just got down into the grammar. You know, you learn that you need core trunk strength before that fine motor strength comes in. In the fingers, things like that. And the other thing that's different, and it really kind of depends on family and community, you know. And I think that a lot of parents report that you know, the things that make the biggest difference, either positive or negative, are the reactions of others. So, you know, if you've got, you know, family and friends who take your kid as like, hey, she's a kid, you know, she might need a little help with this, but this is not a big deal, it becomes not such a big deal. So I would say in a lot of ways, but in a lot of ways it's turned out to be more ordinary than I thought. Now, whether that's because my idea of ordinary changed, I couldn't tell you.
Now, are there different levels of Down syndrome where some kids can have more, I don't know, more profound effects, that they have a harder time developing, or they're more intellectually impaired? How does that work? Are they all kind of the same?
No, there's a huge variation. And just as there's variation in all people. So people with Down syndrome, you know, range all over the place in ability. And, you know, a good thing to remember, too, is that there's, just in terms of the effects of having an extra chromosome, an extra 21st chromosome, you know, it's scattered all over the place. So, you know, you look at something like an IQ score, like a single number, and it doesn't really capture it. because someone might have a real, real hard time with words, but have some compensating ability in something else. You know, and you know, Laura has always been startlingly good, for example, with puzzles. But to answer your question, sure, there's variation, just as there's variation with everyone.
Okay. How has this worked out for her, though, intellectually? Is she able to be mainstreamed in with the kids her own age, or does she have to be in a special ed kind of class?
So that's a really good question. And of course, that's one of those things that has to do not just with Down syndrome, but with our society's response to it.
Yeah.
Since the beginning, our thing was like, hey, you know, she's a kid, she'll do, you know, whatever, Girl Scout soccer, whatever, and we'll make it work, and we'll make it work where it's realistic. Her situation now is she's in sixth grade, she's in middle school, and she loves going there. She's in, you know, in a mainstream, what you might call regular class, about 60% of the time. She's in a smaller group class the rest of the time, and we kind of made that calculation based on where she can get the most out of each situation. So, for example, math, it works better to have direct instruction for that, you know, and same with language arts. Science and social studies, you know, there's ways to make that work. Most of her friends are and have been from the mainstream class, because that's where she's always been. So that's kind of who her buddies are. That's who she hangs out with at lunch. And, you know, you probably remember, at least, I don't know if this is true for you, but for me, this would have been unimaginable when I was a kid in grade school. You know, kids with special needs were essentially on another planet. So,
well, I often wonder that, because I kept thinking, you know, like, where were these kids when I was a kid? And I think the reality was a lot of them were just institutionalized, and they're not exactly on another planet, but certainly not in my zip code.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's even more than that. Depending on when you went to school, the legal right for, you know, a kid with intellectual disability to go to school didn't come along till 1975.
Right. Right.
So you know, there were special ed classes before then, but
right.
So that's a huge social change for the better, I think, and you know,
George Estreich is the author of The Shape of the Eye, a memoir. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to continue talking with George about his daughter, and I'm Armin Brott. You're listening to Positive Parenting.
More with Mr. Dad, Armin Brott, after this, from the MrDad.com radio network.
In 1977, in Johannesburg, South Africa, an 8-year-old boy picked up the game of golf from his father. By the age of 9, he was already outplaying him. The odds of that same boy then making it to the U.S. and European pro golf tours? 1 in 7 million. The odds of the Big Easy winning the Open Championship once and the U.S. Open Championship twice? 1 in 780 million. The odds of this professional golfer having a child diagnosed with autism? 1 in 110. Ernie Els encourages you to learn the signs of autism at autismspeaks.org. Early diagnosis can make a lifetime of difference. Autism Speaks. It's time to listen. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.
Hands can do incredible things. This is the sound of 326 hands playing Mozart. This is the sound of 10,942 hands showing appreciation. 64 hands building a house for the homeless. 142 hands swimming a triathlon. 18 hands winning the big game. And this is the sound of two hands helping to save a life. It's called hands-only CPR, and it's recommended by the American Heart Association. If an adult suddenly collapses, call 911, then push hard and fast in the center of their chest until help arrives. It's incredibly easy and effective. Hands can do incredible things, but nothing compares to using them to help save a life.
Find out more about this latest method of CPR at handsonlycpr.org. A message from the American Heart Association and the Ad Council.
Now, get ready for more positive parenting with Armin Brott from the MrDad.com radio network.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott, continuing our discussion with George Estreich, who's the author of The Shape of the Eye, a memoir. And it is a memoir about his daughter who has Down syndrome. And I'm wondering, you talked about how she has friends.
Sure.
And how is she aware that she's different?
That's a really good question. And that's hard to say. I mean,
because I'm sure she's getting teased a lot, too, by people who are not her friends. And middle school is the perfect time for people to be nasty to each other.
Oh, I know it. I know it. And I have to say that, you know, on the list of parental fears, that, you know, middle school was high up there, because I remember middle school. It's, you know, kids are sorting things out. It's not always pretty. I have to say, I could be totally Pollyannish here, but I don't think she's getting teased. We're really fortunate. We have, you know, it's a good middle school, and people kind of look out for each other. They've got a great anti-bullying program. And, you know, if there were a serious thing going on, we would know. And this may seem paradoxical, but I think Laura gets a little bit of a pass. That she, you know, so if it's Monday and Laura says, okay, you know, my attire for school is going to be the pink tutu and the tiara, I think another girl might just get mercilessly teased for that. But I think she kind of goes her own way, and people go, that's Laura, you know.
That's a credit to everybody around her, I guess, if that's really happening, that how normal it's become, and the parents telling them, the kids. I mean, that sounds to me odd and unusual, but not in a bad way, but just obviously in a good way, but just not typical, I would think.
I just don't know. You know, we're up here in the Pacific Northwest. I don't know. Maybe this is a part of that. I don't know. But yeah. I do have to say, I mean, you know, you asked one of the things that's what different about raising a kid with Down syndrome. And, you know, what I've found over the years is that it really magnifies the typical. So let's say, you know, as a parent, you know, you always have that certain level of protectiveness. Well, if you have a kid with Down syndrome, that gets magnified. But it's the same thing, but it's, like, squared. And so, you know, time after time, I've kind of looked ahead to, like, okay, first day of preschool, first day of kindergarten, first day of middle school, and been really bracing myself. And I won't say there have not been bumps. There always have been. But it's almost never been as bad as I anticipated it was going to be. So, mm-hmm. You know, I feel lucky that way.
Well, you know, when I hear about kids, or when I see kids, and sometimes we'll watch them from afar, and people that I don't know, kids who have a disability of some kind, one of the things that goes through my mind, and I think it's more of a dad thing, and having talked to a lot of dads and moms about this, I always wonder about what's going to happen when I'm older and not able to take care of this child in the same way. Do you worry about self-sufficiency?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think you can't be a parent and not. I mean, there are, you know, we do what we need to. We save. But I know, again, this may seem Pollyannish, because I guess I am kind of a worrier, but I don't lay awake nights over this. I have a good friend who works with adults with disabilities in Benton County, and I see ways that it can work. Part of, I guess, to the extent that I think about that, that shapes my vision of education and being included. So, you know, we've been sure to have Laura in that regular class as much as is practical.
Right,
you know?
Right.
And part of that is, you know, as I've said at different times to teachers, it's like, look, you know, when those services drop out at 18 or 21, she's not going to a special world. She's just going to the real world.
Right.
And the more she understands about, you know, just expects herself to behave by the same standards as quote, normal kids, and to the extent that it's just normal for her to interact with people, I think her way will be smoother. So So that's, you know, that's the way I think about that, making sure that she's good with reading, with she's doing supermarket math now, you know, like how much does something cost, how to add it up. But yeah, I think for any parent, that's got to be something on your mind.
Does she have limits?
Sure.
Intellectually, where she's just not going to be able to get to a certain point?
Sure. Like everyone. I mean, you know, I'm pretty sure I'm not going to be a particle physicist at this point, so I've got my limits there.
Okay.
She does, but, and like, you know, as with any kid, you know, the more you go on, the more you kind of see where those limits are and where you can push them and where not. But, I guess the limits are not something we think a lot about now. We just try and say, okay, let's see how far we can go and help her thrive.
You said she was kind of advanced as far as puzzles. Is there an element of savant that goes along with Down syndrome, or is that what did you mean by
not advanced, like she'll take a 500 piece puzzle and just do it in 3 seconds? Like, no, just more like she can. We would be surprised at a given age that she would just sit there and put something together herself and say, well, okay, well, maybe, you know, the grammar, that language might be tough, as it seems to be tough in Down syndrome, but that she's thinking there and she's seeing the shapes and her intelligence is working that way. Yeah.
You know, you said something else that I thought especially interesting as well, that the gross motor skills and the fine motor skills and physical therapy, I had always thought of Down syndrome as being more of an intellectual issue, and the shape of the body certainly seems a little bit more rotund. But what I didn't realize that there were so many physical issues. What are they? What's going on?
Well, so that there are, when Down syndrome comes from an extra chromosome, and extra chromosome has about 250 genes on it. So that means that affects the body in a lot of ways, having those essentially extra instructions. One thing that can happen with a lot of folks with Down syndrome is to have a little lower muscle tone, right? So PT, physical therapy, helps with that. One thing I write about is that, you know, with Down syndrome, if you just kind of look it up and you say, okay, well, what are the effects of this? You'll see a huge, long laundry list of, like, well, people with Down syndrome have this, you know. And it's true that the number of possible things is very long, but the number of things that any one child has tends to be relatively short. So there's a range of medical risks, and there are some, you know, there's some physical things, too, that are just the way they are. You know, Laura's eyes look a little different. She's shorter. But there's a huge amount of variation there.
Does it affect lifespan?
But that's depending on your point of view on that. That's kind of a success story or not. The current life expectancy for people with Down syndrome in the United States is about 60. So that's come up a long way since even just the 80s, largely because of heart surgery. So some people with Down syndrome, about 40%, have some version of heart defect, and some of those are will watch it and it, you know, settles on its own. Some, like my daughter's, require surgery. So,
she will require surgery?
No, she did. When she was 3.5 months old, she had surgery, and that was a time I don't want to repeat.
Yeah. How does your older daughter deal with this? Does she feel? I mean, especially because when she went through her middle school, now she's and I guess in high school now. Does she feel that she's embarrassed by having a younger sister who's different that way?
No, I don't think so. I think they're, you know, the way I've kind of explained their relationship in the past is those old children's books, Beezus and Ramona. Do you know those from Beverly Crusher?
Oh, yeah.
Sure. So, you know, Ramona is a responsible older sister, and Beezus is Beatrice is a responsible older sister, and Ramona is her younger
She's
sister.
She's the pest.
Yeah, the pest, and who absolutely worships her and bugs her too. So that kind of covers it. But Ellie embarrassed by Laura? I don't know. No, they're not at all. And they're about 5 years apart, and you know, I would say Ellie's pretty protective of Laura for sure.
George Estreich is the author of The Shape of the Eye, a memoir, which is a memoir about his daughter, Laura, who has Down syndrome. George, thanks very much for joining us. Great to have you.
Thanks so much for having me, Armin.
My name's Tyler, and in 9 years, I'll be an alcoholic. I'll start drinking in middle school, just at parties. But my parents won't start talking to me about it till high school.
Kids who drink before age 15 are 5 times more likely to have alcohol problems when they're adults.
The thing is, my parents won't even see it coming.
So start talking before they start drinking. To learn more, go to StopAlcoholAbuse.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, the Ad Council, and this station.
At 4:15 p.m. at an office in Michigan, Angie Hicks is not at her desk. She's giving blood at the company blood drive.
At the same time in the same office, Kevin Meehan is not at his desk. He's at the doctor. Kevin has cancer and needs another round of chemo.
Kevin will need blood to fight his cancer.
Angie's blood will help him win.
When you give blood to the American Red Cross, you change a life.
Starting with your own.
Call 1-800-GIVE-LIFE or visit givelife.org to schedule your appointment to give blood.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott. Let me just jump right into today's email since it deals with something we're all thinking about. Dear Mr. Dad, in today's tough economy, I think it's important to teach kids about the importance of saving money. The problem is that my husband and I don't agree on how to do that. I think we should give the kids an allowance, but he's taking a harder line and says it's important for them to earn their money. What's your opinion? Ah, allowances. Always a thorny subject, huh? Before I jump in and start taking sides on this thing, you're both absolutely right about one thing. People who develop good financial management habits as kids, including learning to become regular savers, are more likely to bring those habits with them into adulthood. And knowing how to manage one's money, especially in uncertain times, is incredibly important. The big question, though, is how people get their money. Here's where I agree with your husband. In my view, when you work hard for your money, you're going to be careful how you spend it. When you just have cash showing up all the time for you, it's a lot easier to fritter it away. I'm sure you've experienced this in action. Have you ever found $20 in the pocket of a jacket you haven't worn for months or years, maybe collected on a sports bet or won a few bucks in a lottery scratcher ticket? If you're like most of us, your first reaction is to go out and spend your unexpected windfall, not put it into savings. Unfortunately, too many people do exactly the same thing with tax refunds. The money, of course, is theirs. They've just loaned it, interest-free, to Uncle Sam. But because they've managed to get along without it for a year, it feels like a gift. The same is true with kids and allowance. When children get money simply for being alive and don't do anything to earn it, they're going to go out and spend it. Oh, and it gets worse from there. The bigger the allowance, the less likely the kids are to save any of it. In fact, a tiny increase, just 1% of the amount of the allowance, reduces by 22% the chance that a child will save. That's according to Sarah Brown and Kurt Taylor, who are researchers at Sheffield University in England. On the other hand, Brown and Taylor found that while kids who earn their money still spend some of it, they were also a lot more likely to save it. Okay, now on to the practical end of things. How are your kids going to earn their money? Child labor laws and school truant officers are going to keep them from getting full-time jobs, but they still have plenty of options, which fall into two broad categories, outside and inside. Outside jobs could be things like watering neighbors' plants or washing their cars, dog or cat sitting, babysitting, paper routes, and even the old standby like selling lemonade and brownies. Inside jobs could include things like helping you install insulation in your attic, organizing your files, or maybe even teaching you how to make better use of your smartphone or tablet. Just as it's important to make a clear distinction between getting an allowance and getting money, it's also important to make a clear distinction between inside jobs and chores. Chores are tasks your children should do simply because they're part of a family. Things like cleaning their rooms, setting and clearing the table, sorting laundry, walking the family dog, vacuuming the carpets, taking out the garbage, and so on. And because everyone in the family has an obligation to keep things running smoothly, chores aren't paid.
Thanks for listening to Positive Parenting. You can get more information on today's show and what we're working on in the weeks ahead at MrDad.com. While you're there, visit the MrDad.com gift shop with everything you need to help you become the dad or mom you want to be. Positive Parenting is a production of the MrDad.com radio network. Now, go be a great parent.